My name is Michael Howley. I'm from Lyme Park, Ardrahan in County Galway. My connection with the Rising is my grandfather, Peter Howley, of Lyme Park, was a volunteer in 1916. He was the captain of the Ardrahan Company of Volunteers during that period. Lyme Park House was chosen as a place to make a stand, as at the time it was unoccupied and it was also very secluded, and it was surrounded by thick shrubberies and trees, which would have made it easier to defend than my own. They reached Lyme Park, depending on reports, between 11 p.m. on the Friday and 1 a.m. on the Saturday morning. Peter Howley and his brother subsequently lived in Lyme Park House after the Black and Tans burnt them out of their home house in 1921. So they moved into Lyme Park House. And my father, Patrick, was born in the house in 1950. So he remembers growing up in the house. And to this day, there's still a thick gorse and shrubbery and trees. They call it the rock. It's practically impenetrable. So it would have been in 1916, even more so. And so therefore, in their view, very easy to defend. Father Fahy and Father Farrell had travelled together by motorcycle, I think up and down the column. But they had gone ahead and they had met the volunteers at the old gate of Lyme Park House. And at this stage, Father Farrell was not in a manic state, but he was very, very concerned for the men. He didn't want them making a final stand, which had been the intention, because of what he had heard had happened in Dublin. Some of it was erroneous, but they had heard awful things that happened in Dublin. So he met them at the gate, and he supposedly cried out to these troop of men who were walking through at midnight, "Lads, you're going to your deaths. You're all going to die." He was pleading with them, because at that point he wanted them to disperse. And I think that probably would have been the view of Father Fahy as well. The company of nearly 400 men and one woman assembled in the front lawn of Lyme Park House. And it was a moonlit night. And my grandfather remembers it had been almost like daylight. The moon was so bright. Mellows and his staff repaired into the house. And they also had five RIC prisoners with them. And they were put in the basement of the house. I think they were prisoners from an attack on my villa, RIC barrack in Ordenmore. Mellows and 12 men met in the front room of the house to discuss what they were going to do, to have a conference. Mellows at that stage had been on his feet for nearly 5 days. And he lay down on the floor and he fell asleep. He was just completely worn out. In the room at the time, we believe, were Mellows himself, Father Tom Fahy, Father Harry Feeney, Alf Monaghan, Frank Hines, Eamon Corbett, Martin Nyland, Larry Lardner, Nick Coyne, Sean Broderick, Mike Athai and Dick Murphy. And I think it's important that, you know, those men's names are mentioned. Father Fahy addressed the group, the gathering, and he informed them of the destruction and the surrender of the rebels in Dublin and the reports of the treatment of the rebels that he had heard. He told them Ireland hadn't risen. And that as far as he knew, Galway was now alone. That they were the only ones left who still hadn't surrendered. And that a ring of police and British soldiers were closing in on them. At that stage, HMS Gloucester had arrived in Galway Bay the previous day. We now know they had disembarked at least 100 men of the Munster Fusiliers to track down the volunteers. So they were on their tail, as it were. After a debate, a vote was taken and went 6-5 to favour of disbanding the volunteers. Mellows, of course, this stage was still asleep. They woke Mellows and the discussion started again. Mellows refused to disband the men. He says, "I brought these men out and I won't disband them." Another vote was taken and this time it passed 10-2. The two men against disbandment were reported to be Mellows himself and Alf Monaghan. Mellows said, "I'm not disbanding them." He ceded command and Father Fahy went out to address the men. That's when they remembered that they still had the five RIC prisoners. At this stage, they'd forgotten about them. The men feared that if these prisoners were released, that they'd identify the men involved with the consequences that obviously happened to the leaders in Dublin. Father Fahy said, "Let me talk to them." And he went down to the men and he told them of the concerns of the volunteers. The RIC constable swore to Father Fahy that if they weren't harmed, they would not identify anyone involved in the Rising. They would not identify their captors. They would point no finger at anyone. And subsequently, in questioning by the superiors, they identified nobody. They all had collective amnesia. And credit to them for that. They didn't have to keep the word afterwards, but they did. Father Fahy then went out. He stood in front of, on the steps of Lyme Park House, the steps up to the front of the house. He stood on the steps and faced the body of men standing in the moonlight. He praised their courage and he said they had shown that the spirit of Irish men was still alive. I think that's how he put it. But they had drawn down a hornet's nest of military and police and now the only sensible course for them was to disperse, go home, hide their weapons, and wait for another day. And he said that day must surely come. My grandfather, then Peter Howley, brought Mellows, Alf Monaghan, and Frank Hines down to his father's house, which was about a mile away. So Peter Howley's sister, my grandaunt Bridget, she was a member of Cumann na mBan. She prepared a meal for the men, and they stayed in the house from about 5 a.m. till about 7 a.m. At that point, then Peter Howley brought them to Peterswell Cross, which was about 2 miles away, and he directed them to a safe house in Ballycahillan belonging to Patsy Corliss. Afterwards, then my grandfather, he went back to the house after leaving Mellows, Monaghan, and Hines, and he was making to go on the run with his brothers when he reports that about 60 RIC pulled up in 12 cars, and they were led by the local sergeant, Sergeant Elliot, whom my grandfather would have had a number of run-ins with, and they were taken to Gort, then to Renmore Barracks in Galway, and then on to Eglinton Street RIC Barracks, where they were interrogated. My grandfather was put on a minesweeper in Galway Bay on his own with an armed guard. He didn't see anyone else. He was asked, could he speak to his brothers, Michael and William, who had been arrested. His brother Patrick hadn't been, and he was refused. He was taken by minesweeper to Cove and then again shipped to Dublin. Now, the reason they shipped them was they were afraid if they transported them over land that they would have been ambushed. He was taken then to Richmond Barracks, and he met Eamon de Valera in Richmond Barracks. He met de Valera, Thomas Ashe, and he said, no, le mass. Eamon de Valera and Thomas Ashe called him aside. They asked him, well, where are you from? And he told them. He told them what happened in Galway. And he said de Valera seemed to be pleased that Galway had risen. De Valera told my grandfather not to make friends with anyone that he didn't know, because the volunteers believed that there was detectives undercover among the volunteers trying to find out who was in command and who was important and who was not. He was there until the 9th of May. Eamon de Valera and Thomas Ashe were taken out for trial while he was there. And he remembers de Valera being taken out, and he shook hands with some of the men and he says, be brave men, it's for a noble cause. On the 9th of May, about 400 prisoners, along with my grandfather, were brought to England by boat. And he then was taken to Wandsworth Prison in London. And he remembers being kept there until about June. And then he was transferred to Frongoch, which in Wales, which is famous. So that's where they stored all the volunteers. He was released in August. So he effectively was only captive for about 3 months. And considering his involvement, he should have been kept captive an awful lot longer. But it subsequently transpired they'd made mistakes with his Christian name. They weren't sure he was who they thought he was, because he found out afterwards that his brothers had been interrogated as to what their first names were. So they couldn't identify which one of them was Peter Howley, so they had to let him go. So he went on, he remained very, very active until the truce was signed in 1921.